evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington.
And I'm Michael Atit, also in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, January 19, 2015. Officials say two well-known businessmen killed in the Nimule over the weekend.
Well, it is very painful because this is an incident which has never happened like this before. This is like a targeted intention, just like what happened with the chief.
And South Sudanese photojournalists say there are more good news in South Sudan.
I'm just trying to change what people are having at the back of their mind. Like the moment you mention South Sudan and they think of war and arms, and we were preparing morally for this panel.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus.
Authorities in South Sudan's border town of Nimule in eastern Equatorial State say two businessmen have been killed in what appears to be a well-coordinated attack. The chief administrator of Pagedi says police are searching for the killers. Philip Thonaleu has this story for VOA from Juba.
Administrator Emilio Iga says the two businessmen were sitting in front of a hotel in Numuli when they were gunned down.
Some minutes past 9 p.m., one gunman came and attacked two of our members, Deputy Senator Anton Gwang, shot them dead in front of Motherland Hotel. The suspects are not yet there, so investigation is still continuing.
Iga says the killings appear to have been well planned before being executed, but declined to offer any details. He says the town has had to be put on lockdown status early today as police, backed by army units, began searching for suspects. Iga says Numuli residents are frightened while at the same time grieving for the two businessmen, Gwanya and Kisiriyara.
Well, it is very painful because this is an incident which has never happened like this before. This is like a targeted intention, just like what happened with the chief, the late chief. He was also ambushed and yet targeted. So this is a planned thing. People are not happy about it. People are very sad. The mood in the town is bad.
The former head chief of Numuli Fayam, George Ajugo Libio, was shot dead in September 2013 while returning to his home. Some suspects were later arrested in connection with the killing. No links have been established between the two separate attacks, according to Iga. Iga says Numuli authorities will beef up security in and around the town to avoid any repeats of yesterday's attack. Mark Oken, the Minister of Information in Eastern Equatorial State, confirmed the killings in Numuli but declined to comment, saying authorities in Taurid are still receiving details of the attack. Numuli residents say shops today remain closed for business in the main market. Numuli, located 193 kilometers south of Juba, is the busiest town along the South Sudan-Uganda border. About 80% of imports to landlocked South Sudan are transported via the Juba-Numuli Highway, the only paved road in the entire country, according to government officials. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleu in Juba.
The government says the fighting that has racked South Sudan for the past 13 months has spread to another state. A spokesman for the army says clashes erupted in Lake State today and blamed the violence on rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar, but the rebels say they have no knowledge of any fighting in Lake State. Worker Simon Wudu has more from Juba.
SPLA spokesman Colonel Philip Aguer says rebel forces deliberately allowed fighting in Unity State to spill over into neighboring Lake State.
The rebel crossed the borders of Unity State. They came from the southern part of Unity State and trying to transport the fighting into Lake by attacking Maper.
Aguer said fighting was still ongoing in the village of Maper when he spoke to South Sudan in Focus. He did not have any casualty figures from the clashes. A spokesman for Machar's rebel group, Lulu Roy Kwang, says he has not heard of any fighting in Lakes or Unity States.
To be sincere, I have no information that is directly linking our forces with the clashes, and therefore do not want to claim responsibility at this point in time until I get in touch with our field commander.
UN-run Radio Miraya reports that several houses were burnt down and an unspecified number of civilians killed in the clashes. The latest fighting comes hot on the heels of clashes in the village of Ondolwich in the northeastern part of Upper Nile State. Aguer says Machar's rebel forces started the fighting in Ondolwich, which is in Reng County, located in the strategic border region with the Sudan.
The fighting took place from 11 in the morning up to afternoon. The SPLA defeated the attack and pursued them up to the borders where they dispersed into two groups. One group crossed the border to the Sudan, and the SPLA stopped at the borders of South Sudan. The other group that have run toward east, toward Nasir, is part of the group that was dispersed after the attack on Delhi.
But Kwong says the SPLA and a Sudan-based rebel group are responsible for the classes.
Over the weekend, government troops supported by fighters from SPLA now attacked our forces at Omdelewich. We fought for over 4 hours. During the first engagement, they had an upper hand and they were able to capture four of our wounded fighters. But in the afternoon, we were able to repulse them and kill 189, including 7 fighters from SPLA North. We captured 133 AK-47 assault rifles, 15 PKM light machine guns, and 10 RPG-7, that's the rocket propelled grenade launchers.
Aguer says the rebels have attacked Ondolwich 4 times. He gave different casualty figures from those given by Kwong.
On the side of the rebels, 24 dead bodies were counted on the ground, and the SPLA captured 4 rebels alive that were brought here to Juba, and we showed them to the media yesterday through South Sudan television. On our side, the SPLA lost 4 killed in action and 15 wounded. The SPLA have captured a number of weapons, including a Toyota mounted with B-10 anti-tank.
Aguer says the SPLA also discovered a rebel storage facility near Jamam village in Maban County in Upper Nile State. He says it contained around 1,000 rocket-propelled grenades, ammunition, and green uniforms that are believed to have come from Sudan. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
VOA fellow Lucy Pony contributed to that report.
And now we move to West Africa for some news about Ebola. Children in Guinea start school year today after a 5-month delay due to Ebola. Liberia plans to reopen schools next month. It's a sign of progress as those two countries turn the tide against the pandemic. But not everyone is sure the countries are ready. VOA's Anne Luke has the story with reporting from Karim Kamara in Conakry and Prince Collins in Monrovia.
Samson Wese's kids ask him every day.
Every day to be, Papa, when will we return to school?
He welcomes the Liberian government's decision to reopen schools in February. Authorities shut them back in July as Ebola cases surged.
My kids been sitting home and doing nothing, playing, running here and there, and nothing like education as well been going on. The more the children sit home, the more they get dull.
Authorities say schools will have all the necessary safety measures, like thermometers and chlorine for hand washing. But some parents in Liberia say they may keep their kids home a while longer. Mother Christine Thomas says she wants the World Health Organization to declare Liberia Ebola-free first.
So my fear here is if the children go to school and they, you know, come down with Ebola, it would not be too good for the parents who will be feeling bad. So we hoping and praying that there will be a little bit of delay in the opening of schools.
In Guinea, teachers express the same concern. They worry about how to limit contact in what are often overcrowded schoolhouses. Teacher Amadou Diallo says the children play together during recess, and no one can stop them from doing that. The students also share food. He says he thinks reopening schools is a risky decision. Ebola is transmitted via contact with a sick person's bodily fluids. Throughout the epidemic, public health experts have downplayed the risk of contagion through casual contact. Teachers in Guinea told VOA that they, along with about 80,000 of their colleagues, have been trained on Ebola. Civil society groups had threatened to protest unless the schools reopened Monday. Now those civil society groups say they will go out and monitor schools to make sure there are hand-washing stations and that kids' temperatures are being taken daily and record it. Fever is an early symptom of Ebola. Schools were only shut for 5 months in Guinea and Liberia, but the challenges are not over. Fear could lead to dropouts. School funding has been diverted to Ebola. In Sierra Leone, where schools remain closed, UNICEF Chief of Education Wangani Grace Nkomataula says teenage pregnancy is up. UNICEF is investigating reports of increased child labor.
The impact of the virus on the education system could be something that really reverses the gains that Sierra Leone has made over the years.
Liberia and Sierra Leone have been using radio and television to broadcast at-home lessons in the interim. But it's no substitute for a classroom, and not all children have had access. Taulo says whenever schools do reopen in Sierra Leone, teachers may need to work evening hours or hold weekend and holiday classes to help kids catch up. Anne Look, VOA News, Lagos.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama addressing the Ebola crisis.
Ebola is actually a difficult disease to catch. It's not transmitted through the air like the flu. You cannot get it from just riding on a plane or a bus. The only way that a person can contract the disease is by coming into direct contact with the bodily fluids of somebody who is already showing symptoms. We know how to fight this disease. We know the protocols. And we know that when they're followed, they work. And if we take the steps that are necessary, if we're guided by the science, the facts, not fear, then I'm absolutely confident that we can prevent a serious outbreak here in the United States, and we can continue to lead the world in this urgent effort.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudanese take part in the National Geographic Photo Cam in Juba. That story is next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you feel you have the ability to achieve your career goals?
Yes, I feel I have the ability to achieve my career goals because I have a family which is very supporting, and I am very focused because I do not want to disappoint my family.
Well, I feel that I have the ability to achieve my goals because I know there are people who would support me to the level that I would be able to be independent and support myself as well.
I think I have the ability to achieve them because I'm studying entrepreneurship, which will help me. For example, I may be a professional teacher as I study. I may plan for my own business as I study entrepreneurship.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. You might know National Geographic from its magazines, which are full of beautiful photographs from around the world. Well, National Geographic also organizes training camps for potential photographers. And last year, it held its first photo camp in South Sudan. At least 100 young people applied for a place in the camp, which was held in Juba. 20 applicants were accepted, and last week, 3 of them came to Washington to share their experience at the photo camp. South Sudan in Focus web editor Karen Zaivogo met with young photographers at a National Geographic headquarters in the U.S. Capitol and sent us this audio snapshot.
Photo Camp was focused on peace building and reconciliation. The youth that came together, the stories they were able to tell, and the photographs themselves, as you see in the presentation, are all truly amazing.
The goal was to go out into the communities in Juba, specific areas, and look at areas in which individuals from different ethnic groups, different tribes, were actually interacting in peaceful and positive ways.
My name is Akwad Sol Mayag.
I'm Catherine Simon Arona.
My name is Duke Steven Savio. Yeah, my photography was supposed to show about Actually, I went to kickboxing to show peace-building initiatives. One of South Sudanese who live in Canada, he went back to South Sudan to open a place for kickboxing so that the young people cannot go in fail for war, but they can join for a peace initiative program. They play, they beat themselves for peace.
Because I was among the students that has been taken to go and cover the life story of the camp. That was my dream, really, to go to that place, because my whole life I have been a refugee for my whole life. But when I was taken there, I feel that I was documented my life. So I was feeling great. And I take a step ahead and I said, this is the right time that I will cover my story that I left behind. Yet it was a different person that I was covering. I was covering my whole life story. Well, it has really opened our mind beyond just taking pictures, but it's beyond understanding how you can understand the world and what world needs in that picture. And during the time when we're not trained, I myself, I used to take pictures. But those pictures, they cannot tell a full story that what people need in a society. But when I was trained, I come to know that this is a picture that need people to know the story behind that. And I have been trained also, know which angle can you place your camera to take a picture that will attract the story behind that. And it was really a great moment for National Geographic to come and train me and become now a photojournalist, photographer, and I like that.
The camp that they have done has progressed, and the students are doing great. It is the first time, and they say the work of a student is good. And I think they have the decision to do more camps in South Sudan, because they basically do the camp in Juba. They have to decide and do in other state of South Sudan. Also, the younger brothers of ours in the state can able to improve also in photographing skills.
Photography is such a wide ocean that the more you go deep down, the more you know it better and you get to know a lot of things.
Through my pictures, I humanize the life of South Sudanese. The daily life, the details of what they are doing and the activities that they have. Like I mentioned before, in Juba specifically, we have weddings every Saturday. So I'm just trying to change what people are having at the back of their mind. Like the moment you mention South Sudan and they think of war and arms and all that, we were preparing morally for this panel. And then this lady, she came and she was like, is everything okay? Are you all set? We said, yeah, nice, thank you. We have our tea and everything. And then she said, where are you guys from? We said, South Sudan. She was, oh, yeah? How's the war over there? I paused for some second. It's like, seriously? And this is the reaction. So I'm trying to view South Sudan as from a different angle.
That was Catherine Arona, Akwad Mayak, and Duku Savio, all three students in Juba, who were lucky enough to take part in the first National Geographic Photo Camp to be held in South Sudan.
There was more deadly fighting between communities in northern Barry County. Local officials say four people were killed and four others injured yesterday when members from the Barry community clashed with the Mundari in northern Barry Payam of Juba County in central Equatoria State. Local leaders say fighting is continuing and they expect more dead to rise. Charlton Doki reports for VOA from Juba.
Local leaders say the fighting started on Sunday when members of the Mundari community attacked the Barry community. Saturino Ladu is coordinator of South Sudan's Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Juba County.
Within the clashes which happened yesterday, there are four cases of death reported. Three from civilian and then one from army. Then four people were wounded and I cannot actually determine the right figure of the dead and then the one of wounded because it's still the crisis is continuing.
Ladu says several people are missing after yesterday's clashes. He was speaking from the Juba One Basic School, where more than 300 people caught up in yesterday's fighting are seeking refuge.
The number of people displaced of the population reported currently now when I'm speaking, because the figure is increasing, is now 400. Men, women, and small children.
Dementilia Kaku, one of the women who fled the village, says the fighting started over cattle grazing. She says just before the fighting started, Mundari cattle herders came to graze their cattle in a village neighboring hers. She says the people in that village asked the cattle herders why they were grazing on that land. Immediately, she says, one of the boys herding cattle started to fight, beating the other boy with a stick. Kaku says immediately after that, they started shooting guns. She says the villagers did not know the reason the cattle herders came to fight them. She says then they intensified their gunshots, and at this time, none of us could understand what was exactly taking place. She says it was not her community that started the fighting. I cannot know their number because we were in our place in Koriji when they started the fighting in Tijeri on the other side of the road from Terekeka, she added. Kaku says by the time the fighting reached them, people had already started scattering. Local leaders say more than 6,700 people have been displaced from the area since intercommunal clashes between the Bari and Mundari began 10 years ago. The clashes started after the Mundari, who had settled in the northern Bari area as internally displaced persons during the civil war with Sudan, resisted a government order to return to their home county, Terekeka, after the end of the war in 2005. George Bureng represents the area in South Sudan's National Legislative Assembly.
Since 2005, northern Bari Payam has never had any peace. Peace from our neighbors. Issues of cattle, land grabbing, cattle stealing, destruction of gardens, raping, and absolute war on the people in this area based on our neighbors to the north. We have made a number of attempts. Somehow it falls on deaf ear. We have met the commission a number of times. The governor has not made an effort to address this issue. This is squarely on the footstep of the governor. And the people causing this are the people of the governor. And the governor is the chairman of the Mundari community.
Bureng says he does not understand why the Mundari and Bari communities, which have lived peacefully side by side for several centuries, should be fighting now.
We have intermarried with the Mundari. We are close neighbors. This thing has never happened in history. Why is this thing happening? Why are they attacking people in their villages? Why are they burning houses? Why are they grazing their cattle in people's farms at a time when we are in trouble with issues of food security?
Ladu is appealing to aid groups to provide humanitarian assistance to the thousands of displaced residents in the area and for the government to step in.
I expected more people will report here today. So I appeal to the UN agencies, humanitarian bodies, to rescue the situation of the people. And then also, as a humanitarian person, I'm appealing to the government to stop that situation.
Local leaders say they are working to establish the exact number of displaced and to determine their needs. Last November, clashes between the Mundari and Bari communities over land in the Jebel Ladu area of Juba County left scores dead and injured. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
The World Health Organization say 16 million people under the age of 70 are dying immaturely every year from non-communicable diseases. A new report is calling for the action to reduce these largely preventable deaths. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Non-communicable diseases are the leading cause of death worldwide, accounting for 63% of all yearly deaths. The World Health Organization reports millions of people are dying prematurely from four major types of illnesses: heart and lung diseases, stroke, cancer, and diabetes. WHO cites tobacco use, the harmful use of alcohol, unhealthy diets, and physical inactivity as the four major risk factors, and notes embracing healthier lifestyles can significantly reduce these these premature deaths. The lead author of the report, Shanti Mendes, is WHO coordinator for chronic diseases prevention and management. She calls non-communicable diseases a slow-motion public health disaster.
We are losing 16 million people every year in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, not in their 80s and 90s. And we are losing 38 million from NCDs overall every year. Out of the 16 million people who die under the age of 70, who are in their productive years, 82% are in low and middle income countries, which don't have the capacity to really address them.
In 2013, the World Health Assembly approved a global action plan that aims to reduce the number of premature deaths from non-communicable diseases by one quarter by 2025. The plan includes 9 voluntary global targets to tackle key risk factors. The report describes inroads being made by several countries that are implementing some of these strategies. For example, it notes smoking rates in Turkey have declined by 13% since the government increased the size of health warnings on tobacco products and increased taxes. While such progress is encouraging, WHO finds most countries are not on track to meet the 2025 goal. Dr. Mendes says many lives could be saved if countries implement a few low-cost strategies. These include a ban on all forms of tobacco advertising, replacing trans fats with polyunsaturated fats, restricting or banning alcohol advertising, and promoting healthy diets and physical activity. She tells VOA another serious problem that must be tackled is obesity in young children. She says 42 million children under age 5 are overweight and 5 million are obese. She says this is frightening because behaviors that are learned at a very young age are set for life.
Obesity contributes to so many comorbidities. What do I mean that? What I mean by that? If you're obese, you are more prone to develop high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, arthritic complaints, cancer, among other diseases. So you are set to develop chronic diseases in later life. What is really, again, alarming is in the last couple of years, the rise in obesity is highest in some African countries. The actual levels may be low now, but the rising trend is remarkable in those countries.
The World Health Organization says a small investment equal to $1 to $3 per person per year could dramatically reduce illness and death from NCDs. Globally, this amounts to $11.2 billion a year. That may sound like a lot until it is compared with the cost of doing business as usual in low and middle income countries. The WHO estimates from 2011 to 2025, cumulative economic losses in those countries due to NCDs will amount to $7 trillion. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's our show for this Monday on Martin Luther Day here in Washington. We now leave you with a song about corruption from Ugandan musicians. Listening to that music by Ugandan musicians about corruption. I'm John Tanza in Washington.
And I'm Michael Atit, also in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Nasa sete, babuko. Wata sete, babuko.